Blog Talk Radio.
Oh,
I
like to talk over you.
Yeah. Hello, welcome to our radio show on Free Choice Learning. And this is the show associated with primarily SED 582 at Oregon State University, talking about free choice learning and particularly the personal dimensions of free choice learning. I am John Falk, and I am professor in charge of this course, and I'm also the host of this radio show. And I'm really pleased today to have with me as a special guest Dr. Nancy Staus, who's also at Oregon State. She is a, what is your title?
Senior Research Associate.
Senior Research Associate. It says that right here.
Oh, good.
Senior Researcher at Oregon State University. And so we're now about to, we've finished up our first two-week module, and thank you almost all of you who turned in your assignments in a timely way, and we did what hopefully most of you found to be an interesting little exercise to try and learn more about the science interest of several individuals and how they came to become interested in that topic. And we are moving into this new module, which is talking about prior knowledge and experience and advanced organizers. But we're going to dwell a little longer on interest in today's show because we have the opportunity. Nancy here is an expert on interest and also emotion. And if we have a little time during the show, we'll talk about that as well. But as I've discovered over my 40 years of doing research in this area, that actually interest is really, really important. And that often the topic of interest gets short shrift when talking about science learning. We usually dive straight into content and say, of course, people have to be interested, but if we can, but we can make it interesting for them. And that's what's really important. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But before we do that, I'm going to ask Nancy to introduce herself, talk a little bit about herself, share with you her interests and how she got to be involved in doing the kind of research that she's doing. And maybe she'll even talk about the kind of research she's doing. So anyway, Nancy, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, thank you, John. And I guess if anyone can't hear us at any time, you can contact us somehow on this, I'm assuming. Anyway, my name is Nancy Staus. And as John mentioned, I got my PhD in science education at OSU, as many of you are probably doing who are taking this course. Back in 2012, I finished up. And just full disclosure, John was my advisor. And I came to science education through somewhat circuitous path, I guess. Before getting my PhD, I was a biologist and landscape ecologist focusing on conservation and sustainability issues for about 15 years. And also while I was doing mostly research in those areas, I was became interested in, you know, most of our research went to practitioners, but I thought it was interesting, it would be interesting for just lay people to know more about conservation and sustainability issues, and they weren't probably getting access to them from our work because we published in journals and wrote reports and that sort of thing. And so I began to teach an introductory non-majors biology course at Lynn Benton Community College. And as I began teaching there, I realized a couple of things. First, I didn't really have a good idea of how people learn. So here I was trying to teach people about biology and ecology, something I was really passionate about, but I didn't really understand how do people learn science and particularly biology, ecology topics. And so that kind of got me thinking also about I was trying to impart all this knowledge to people, but there was a lot of emotion in the classroom, particularly with certain topics that you can probably imagine, things like evolution, climate change brought up a lot of emotional reactions that I didn't really know how to deal with in a learning situation. And so this kind of got me thinking about, well, there must be people who know the answers to these questions. And I started looking at the science education PhD program at OSU, and as part of my midlife crisis, PhD, and the focus of my dissertation was actually related to how people learn, particularly the role of emotion in the learning of science and particularly natural science topics. So that's how I got here.
Great. So one of the big topics that we talked about at the beginning of this course, since for many of the students this is their first course in this whole free choice learning program, but even if it isn't, we really started at the beginning to say, well, everybody has this sort of generalized notion of what learning is. People have an intuitive understanding of that. On the other hand, that intuitive understanding may or may not be accurate. And most people's perceptions of what is learning have been strongly influenced, and I would editorialize and say strongly warped, by their experiences in formal education. And most of the public's perception of what is learning has been shaped by their experiences in school. And so one of the things that I had everybody do in the beginning of the class was, before we even, you know, really as a first exercise, was to say how they define learning. And one of the first things I did, perhaps ad nauseum, in the first radio show a couple weeks ago, was give my definition of learning. And so, as I've been wont to do on all these radio shows, I'd love to hear, Nancy, how you define learning. Just because there actually isn't a single definition that is uniformly accepted and followed by everybody who works in this area.
Okay. Well, having at one time been one of those warts people, particularly before I got involved in the PhD program here at OSU, and I probably would have had a very different answer to what is learning back then, although I can't tell you what it would have been. But now I think of it really broadly. I think of it as the process of making meaning of the world around us. And, you know, I think, and, you know, John will appreciate this, learning doesn't just take place at school. Learning is a process that takes place anywhere, anytime, with any number of people. There doesn't have to be a formal teacher involved. You can learn things on your own. You can learn things from friends, from your family, from an expert, from a book. And learning can take different forms. And so it can be formal, systematic study, like you're doing, if you're doing your PhD, that would be a formal systematic study, but it can also take place through just general exploration of the world around you through the experiences that you have and talking to other people. And so the other thing about learning is, you know, learning outcomes, you know, we tend to think of them as changes in our knowledge, and of course that's true, but I think it also, you know, there's changes in your skills and in your behaviors as well. But no matter what, when you learn, you change yourself in real physical ways. You're changing your brain and the connections that are being made. You're changing possibly your identity, and so it is a an experience that changes you.
Cool. So before getting much further, I want to remind any of you out there in the world who are actually listening live at the moment, as opposed to on a podcast, that we welcome everyone and anyone who's calling to who's listening to call in, to ask Nancy a question, to ask me a question, or just to reflect on what we've done, including to call in and reflect on any thoughts or comments regarding the first module, first 2 weeks of the course. The call-in number again is 657-383-1722. And let me say that again, 657-383-1722. And I get sort of focused on looking at my guest and thinking and talking, and sometimes forget to look down and notice whether people are calling in, but I'm going to try and be good and pay attention so that if you're calling, you won't be holding too long. And of course, if we have multiple callers, which would be a treat, I indulge you to be patient. Again, that number is 657-383-1722. So don't hesitate to call in at any time.
Sounds like you're the NPR person.
I know. And you know, and
call with your pledge.
If you want to pledge money, that's okay too. I can give you an account to send that money to. Just joking. Well, not really. Any rate, so let's move on. We got a lot to talk about today. So, you know, the topic for this new module is talking about prior knowledge and experience, advanced organizers, a little bit about individual differences, potentially. But as I said, I want to sort of go back to first principles, which I believe starts with interest, and let Nancy talk a little bit about some of the research that she's been doing and what she knows about the role of interest in learning and how interest affects things like knowledge and experience.
Okay. So, and I just want to reiterate, we'd love to chat with you if you wanted to call. So don't be shy. And so I wanted to start with just the construct of interest, because it's another one of those, like learning. It's like we all know what it is. We all understand what it is. But then if you're pushed to define it, you realize how complex it really is. So if I were to ask you, tell me something you're really interested in, you probably wouldn't say to me, well, what do you mean by that? You would probably tell me about something you're really interested in. Oh, I'm really interested in baking bread or whatever. And then you tell me about that interest. And so we all have this intuitive notion of what interest is. But then some alien came down from Mars and said, explain to me what interest is. Well, then you start to realize how complex it is. Oh, did someone call in?
Someone called in and actually has been here for almost 2 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
And somehow I missed that. Okay. So hi there. Who do we have on the line here?
Oh, hi, this is Yuna. Hi, John, and hi, Nancy.
Hi, Yuna. How are you? Sorry again, as I said, you know, I get so focused, I forgot to look down.
Oh, no worries.
What's on your mind?
I guess I don't want to veer us off topic too much, but I'm actually very interested on the idea of emotion that Nancy looked at for her dissertation. So, to the extent that is possible, like, what is it did you find, Nancy, about the role of emotion in learning?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to suggest, Yuna, is that we're definitely going to get there. And maybe what I'll do is ask Nancy, as she's talking about interest, because, in fact, interest is not unrelated to emotion, and emotion is not unrelated to knowledge. And maybe rather than talking about it as a separate topic, maybe she can start trying to weave conversation about emotion into her conversation. It's one of the unfortunate products, I believe, of particularly the 1950s, where we sliced emotion off as if emotion was somehow different and unique from cognition. And that was an unfortunate decision. So thank you for calling in. And if we don't do justice to this topic, I'm going to encourage you to call back and say, well, that was great, John and Nancy, but you didn't quite get where I wanted you to go on that. So I'm gonna hang up on you here. And
all right.
But encourage you to call back if we don't deal with this sufficiently. Okay?
Thanks. Okay, so imagine if you were in charge of explaining to an alien what interest was. So when you think about it, the first thing that would come to mind would be probably something that you really like. But if you thought further, you'd realize, well, I like a lot of things that I wouldn't really say I'm interested in. You know, I like ice cream, but I'm not really interested in ice cream. And so liking is a part of interest, and it's part of what we call the affective state or the feeling states or emotion. And that's definitely a big part of interest, especially in earlier phases of interest. There's this emotional component, and then also a cognitive component where that includes knowledge and value for the topic or subject or object of interest. And I would argue that there's also a behavioral component, because when you're really interested in something, you're predisposed to try to re-engage with that topic or activity as much as you can, because you want to learn more about it and become better at it. And so interest is this sort of this complex construct that's made up partially of affect or emotion and partially of cognition and behavior. And those aspects are change in importance at different phases of interest. And so I guess you guys probably read, did they read Heidi and Menninger?
That was a suggested but not required.
Okay.
Although, yeah, no, I don't think they.
Okay.
So why don't you go into that?
Okay. So most interest researchers agree that there are different phases of interest. So not all interest is alike. And while the number of phases isn't 100% agreed on, everyone agrees that there are at least two kinds. So situational interest, which is an early phase of interest, which is triggered by novel or exciting topics or activities.
Like this radio show.
Exactly. And that with the proper support, over time, that interest could develop into what we call an individual interest, which is much more permanent and lasting and has a lot more of an intrinsic motivation component to it. So when you have a situational interest, you need a lot of external support to maintain that interest, because you're not really there. You know, you grabbed me. You walk into chemistry class and your teacher does this experiment and something blows up in a beaker. Boom, he's got you. That's situational interest. But in order for you to develop a more long-lasting individual interest in chemistry, there's got to be more to it. And they've got to provide activities that keep your interest peaked, maintain that interest over time, support you in your learning, provide answers to any questions you have. And once you have crossed the threshold into individual interest, you don't need so much external support. You're the one who goes out and finds the activities and the opportunities and does the learning for yourself. For example, you know, if you were interested in beekeeping, you might, and it was an individual interest, you might be the one who goes and finds some expert beekeeper in town and goes and talks to them and asks them questions. And so at any one time, you may have a lot of situational interests, which really are have a very strong affective emotional component to them, but you really only have a handful of well-developed individual interests. And if you sat down and thought about it, you could probably make a list of maybe not your situational interests, but what you think your individual interests are.
So, for example, all the folks that you students interviewed for this Module 1 exercise, the interests that they were talking about were these deep individual interests, as opposed to their situational interests. But all of that got started at some point, and for most of them, during childhood or adolescence, that's one of the interesting things about the sort of research protocol, is that over the past nearly a decade, that I've been asking people to collect this kind of information, and I've been collecting information, you find that almost uniformly, the interests that people have, that they pursue, these deep individual interests, whether they are professional interests, things that they do for a job, or whether they turn out to be more avocational or hobbies. So the person who discovered one of our students discovered that she didn't realize that her father-in-law really loved astronomy and was an avid amateur astronomer. Oh. And she never knew that. So these deep individual interests invariably arise early, usually around 8, 10, 12, sometimes 14, 15 years, but in that window. And they stick with people for long periods of time. So what is it, how do we get there? How do we get from having done 100 situated interests, which by the way is the kind of interest that disproportionately both formal education and informal education tends to focus on. You know, we tend to blow things up in classrooms or blow things up in science centers or try to create a beautiful video or image on a website or some kind of wow in an initial experience, and we think we've done our job. But in fact, that's the first part of the job. But then how do you get people along that pathway, that trajectory, from situated to individual interest?
Well, that's a great question, and it's an area of a lot of research. And to be honest, we don't know for sure, but we certainly have some good hypotheses. So one of the challenges in interest research that is still ongoing and that people are looking into is, where is that threshold? How do we know when someone has crossed that threshold between situational and individual interest? And what can we do to help people along on that journey? And so the Synergy Project, do they know the Synergy Project?
You've talked about it. No, I mentioned it, but start from the...
So I've been working on this project with John here and Lynn Dierking. And I've been on it for 4 years and they've been on it for longer. And what we're trying to better understand, we're working in one school district in Portland, and we're trying to better understand STEM interest pathways that middle school youth are on and what factors affect those interests. And so one of the things that we're trying to figure out is which of these kids are showing situational interest in STEM, which are showing individual interest in some aspect of STEM, and can we figure out how the ones with the individual interest got there? And so one important thing we know, in order for you to remain interested in a topic, you have to be able to re-engage in it and have exposure to it. You can't just watch the chemistry explosion and then move on to the next thing and remain interested in chemistry. There has to be continuity. You have to have a bunch of different experiences related to that topic, and you have to have some success with it also. You have to feel like you're good at it. And so one of the interesting findings from the Synergies Project was that many school topics generate pretty strong situational interest, and one that we were looking at was astronomy. And there's a sixth grade unit in astronomy in this school district, and we give a survey each year, and we gave it to the kids shortly after their astronomy unit. And one of the questions on the survey is there some particular science topic that you're really interested in? Well, lo and behold, all of a sudden astronomy showed up, you know, like for a huge portion, I think at least half the kids, astronomy, this is it, I'm really interested. And the kids that we were doing case studies with, so we were interviewing them, we had one girl who didn't even like science, who told me shortly after that unit, oh, I want to be an astronomer now, because it was so interesting. I just love this unit. And so the unit lasted however long units last, X number of weeks, and school moved on. And there weren't any other easily accessible astronomy experiences for these kids at that time. And so by the next year we gave the survey, the interest in astronomy had, of course, waned. So one of our hypotheses and something we're trying to do in our phase two of the Synergies Project is to try to make these connections for kids. We're trying to connect what happens in school with the kinds of programs kids have access to out of school. And so if there are kids who get really jazzed about astronomy or cells or what have you, they will be able to re-engage with the content in those activities outside of school. And what we're hoping is to develop a network so that when they finish in school and they go to, let's say, 4-H Science Club does a unit on astronomy. And when that unit's over, well, 4-H directs kids to another resource where they can engage in astronomy. And so in this way, kids can re-engage and experience different aspects of something that they have a situation in, and over time, hopefully, the interest will develop into an individual interest, and then they won't need quite so much external support to maintain it.
Thanks. In fact, again, to sort of editorializing, one of the things that we do not do very well in science and technology and engineering and math is create opportunities for kids to become truly expert in those areas. Most of the experiences that we have are more of a situated, are designed to facilitate a situated interest as opposed to a deeper individual interest. And this is by comparison to, for example, music or sports, where there are opportunities for kids to develop mastery in those. There are all kinds of programs that allow kids who find that they have an interest in a sport, for example, to pursue that at ever deeper and more competitive levels. In fact, probably the best example of that in many ways are martial arts, where you can go in and take a beginning class if you're interested, and then you can keep progressing and keep progressing and keep progressing. And the goal of those martial arts programs are to develop mastery. But that is not the way we run most science education and STEM education programs. It really is, let's get you excited about it, then you're on your own. And so, again, one of the things that at least several of the programs that I'm involved in is trying to deeply think about how would you develop more mastery for these kids? How would you mentor them to support those interests? So again, one of the things we've talked about with the Synergies program, we haven't pulled it off yet, is actually connecting kids to mentors and not with the traditional sort of big brother, big sister model, where all that matters are the industry model. All that matters is you have somebody who's older than you, who espouses a desire to be your mentor, but actually connecting kids with mentors who share their interests so that that person could actually guide somebody. So if you were interested in astronomy, this would be somebody who actually knows something about astronomy and could actually support you in further steps along the way in achieving mastery in a particular topic. So let's move on. But before we do, we've got a caller. So let me see who this is. Hi there. Who do we have with us?
Oh, hi. This is Amber.
Hi, Amber. How are you?
Hi. Sorry. I know I called last time, but I had
no.
to call in. Especially
no, you
when,
can call often. Don't worry that you called last time. Just I appreciate you calling. So what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to kind of quickly just ask this question while Nancy was wrapping up the topic. So when she was speaking about situational and individual, and then the astronomy example she just gave for the Synergies project, I was curious. I mean, that example was kind of a real-time study that's been done, and I was curious if any longevity studies like that have been done with adults or even people who are seniors to kind of see how maybe they've stayed with an individual interest, especially with respect to informal ed.
Any ideas, John?
That's
Sorry.
A really, really. No, that's a great. It's a great question, Amber. And I don't think there is a good answer to that. I know I had another doctoral student who has done some research on hobbyists, and there's sort of a fledgling group of people who are beginning to explore how hobbyists develop their interests over time. And I don't know that they have a concrete answer to that question that you're posing, Amber, but I know, for example, my student, his name is Michael, is his English version of his name, Lou, he's actually Taiwanese. He was looking at koi hobbyists. And what was really interesting, he was particularly looking at sort of the amount of learning that happens at different stages along a hobbyist's trajectory of their hobby, from being just total neophytes to being, again, masters. And not surprisingly, most of the research that was done on hobbyists has been done from at the point where people already would consider themselves a hobbyist. And I really encouraged him to look at people even before they became officially a hobbyist. And that turned out to be very fruitful because an awful lot of the peak in trying to figure out and learn about, for example, koi, happened before someone became a hobbyist. And then again, before they decided to really say, well, I've been doing this for a while, and now I want to become a master hobbyist. I want to be a master gardener. I want to be a master koi hobbyist. I want to be able to show koi professionally, or I want to be able to really up my game as an amateur astronomer and be able to present to other groups, to present at conferences. And there were, as a consequence, there were really two peaks that happened in terms of changes in knowledge and understanding. It was before one became a hobbyist and before one became a master. Because if you might have had the situated interest, but then you had to decide whether it was worth investing your time and energy in actually becoming a hobbyist. And there were people who invested a lot of time and energy in trying to figure out what's involved in doing this. And that was a time, that was a critical time. And I think that that was a key time between, there was a threshold there between just moving from that situated to more individual interest. But there was a second threshold that happened. Okay, well, you know, I bought a telescope and I go out every month or seven and use my telescope to look at the stars. But if I'm really gonna ramp this up and truly be a hardcore professional astronomer, or if I really want to now know enough about koi that I can actually show that, you know, take my koi to shows and be competitive, or if I want to really get serious about being a gardener, then there was another threshold that had to be reached where you took that hobby seriously enough and you actually invested the time and energy in learning how to be really a good gardener as opposed to an average gardener, or really an amateur, actually a serious astronomer as opposed to a year astronomer. And so I think there are two peaks that happen in this process. And people use different resources at different times to achieve those. So much as you were collecting data from folks and asked them what resources they use to basically support their interest professional or hobby. And originally, they were drawing from the internet, or they might use books or television shows to get them interested. But ultimately, if they wanted to get serious about being a more professional in their, or at a higher level in terms of their interest, actually at that point, it segues mostly into apprenticeship kinds of relationships. At that point, you actually need to find somebody who will take you under their wing, so to speak, and help you gain the information. And you may still use books and you may still use the internet, but you need to know what the right books are and the right internet sites. And there is no substitute for peer-to-peer support at that point. So I think that sort of answers your question.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in, Amber. That was a great question.
So something came to mind while you were talking, and this doesn't necessarily answer what Amber was asking, because I don't think there's a lot of research on that, particularly longitudinal. But coming from the Synergies Project, which is longitudinal, it is middle school kids, so I can't say anything about what will happen when they're older. But we were able to group kids into kids who weren't very interested in STEM versus kids who were seemed to be, if not have an individual interest in STEM, it was getting there. And what we found at that age that were the major influences on whether you were STEM interested or STEM disinterested turned out not to be any school variables necessarily. It didn't have to do with your teacher. It didn't really have to do with your school in any way. What we found were the predictors of being STEM interested were how your parents felt about STEM, or how you thought your parents felt about STEM.
Whether they supported you.
Right, and whether they had a positive attitude towards STEM. That was a huge predictor. Another predictor was how often you participated in after-school STEM-related programs. And what was the third one?
And the third one had to do, I thought it had to do with their self-perceptions and their, whether they...
Oh, no, it wasn't self-perception.
Whether they thought it was a
valuable...
Valuable,
relevant, yes.
It was relevant.
Relevant. And actually, whether they found STEM difficult or not was not important. And that's something that's coming out in the research a lot lately. So I don't know if you've read things by Robert Tye, Adam Maltese, about they do longitudinal research on interest in science as well. And what they've found is people who persist in STEM over time, it's mainly due to an early interest in STEM and has much less to do with your achievement. So you may not be getting good grades in STEM, but if you're interested, you are far more likely to end up in a STEM major or STEM career based on your interest in middle or high school rather than on your academic achievement. And so that's just something that's been coming out in a few studies recently that's really interesting.
Yep. So let's do a little segue here. And coming back to Yuna's question about emotion, talk to us, and this is where you can talk about some of your dissertation research, Nancy. Talk about the relationship between emotion and knowledge and how the brain works in terms of all that good stuff. Why, when we think about learning, historically we've thought about it primarily as this primarily Cartesian Descartes notion of, you know, rational thought, as opposed to, you know, God forbid we should be emotional about things.
Yeah, so definitely learning has always been thought of as being highly cognitive. And of course, there's a lot of cognition going on. And so, you know, the when we think of scientists, we think of them as objective and rational, and you know, they certainly wouldn't let those pesky emotions get in their way. But there's actually a lot of evidence that emotion is not only important in learning, and that includes learning science, but that in order for us to function and make decisions, it's absolutely necessary. And so I'm thinking of a study that was done in the neurosciences. And so a lot of neuroscientific research is looking at how people with different brain lesions or, you know, head trauma in certain areas of the brain, how they're able to learn or make decisions. And so they took, you know, a group of regular people who didn't have any problems and a group of people with lesions in the areas of their brain where they process emotion. And they gave them this gambling task that on the face of it looks completely cognitive and rational and objective. And if you had lesions in your emotion processing areas, you should do just twice as well because there's no emotion involved in any of that. And what they found was the exact opposite, is the people with those lesions were just unable to make the decisions they needed to make to succeed in this gambling task. It was people who were using emotion and cognition together that were able to make the decisions to succeed. And so even though you may feel like you're not being emotional when you're learning or thinking about things, you really can't, you know, pull apart your emotions from your cognition in that way. And so for the research that I did, I was trying to better understand, well, how much, you know, I wanted to quantify kind of how much of learning outcomes could we say is due to emotional variables. And so I did an experiment it was in a psychology laboratory, and I wanted it still to have to do with science. So I had volunteers sit and watch two different videos about wildlife. And one of the videos was very exciting in a negative way. There was a little calf, a little water buffalo calf who nearly was eaten by lions. He did get away at the end. And then the other half of the participants watched just a neutral video of, you know, animals grazing peacefully. And so I figured, okay, so we have really strong emotion in one and not much emotion in the other, and let's see what happens. And they watch the video, and then they read some information about the biology and conservation of these water buffaloes, and then they... Cape buffaloes. and then they take a little test. And so I wasn't trying to find out really in-depth learning. It was really a short-term learning kind of thing. And so I had them rate on a scale, you know, how exciting and how... So emotion can be parsed into two different dimensions: arousal, which is excitement, versus boredom, and what's called valence, which is the level of pleasant to, on the other end, very unpleasant. And people rated the videos, you know, did you find it very arousing, very boring, or something in between, and pleasant or unpleasant. And what I found was that the people who rated who found their video more arousing and less pleasant had significantly higher short-term learning outcomes. And also, those variables accounted for 14% of the variance in learning. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but considering how complex learning is and just looking at, you know, a handful of variables accounting for, you know, 14 or 15%, it seems kind of like there's something there. And, you know, I'm not the first one to look at emotion in learning. The neuroscience, people in neurosciences and psychology were the first to look at that. Education is kind of late to the party, but there's a lot more education research coming out where they admit that, oh, yeah, there might be some emotions involved in learning. We should look at that. And neuroscientists and psychologists have shown that there's, you know, shown empirically by looking at people's brains while they're learning or doing tasks or whatnot, that emotional feelings strongly affect attention, which of course is a vital precursor to learning. You're not going to learn something you're not paying attention to. Vitally important in memory, highly arousing experiences are going to be much more memorable. So, you know, think about where you were on 9/11. You know, I'd ask old people, where were you when JFK was shot? Right, John?
Right.
Were you around?
I was.
Okay, where were you?
I was actually at school.
Okay.
And remember that?
They had schools back then.
They had schools even back
okay,
then.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I mean, they looked exactly the same, mind you.
They haven't changed. And you know, and you're not going to learn something if you can't remember it. So very important in memory. Valence, which is the pleasantness, unpleasantness with unpleasantness component, is much more ambiguous in learning. There's some research that shows that pleasant activities are more memorable, and others show that unpleasant activities are more memorable. My research showed that unpleasant, watching an unpleasant video, was much more memorable than a pleasant video. But there's, you know, definitely a strong emotional component to learning that needs to be attended to if we're going to better understand how to facilitate people's learning.
Cool, thanks. So let me once again urge any of you out there in listening land who might want to give us a call at 657-383-1722. Call in and give your questions. Actually, I'm going to, before we segue to another topic, I'm going to pose a question that was asked by Tanya McDonald, who sent me an email and said that unfortunately she wasn't going to be able to listen live, but she had a question. And I'm going to preface it, and I'm not sure that we have a great online answer, but we have some thoughts of where you can look. She asked, she said that working in family learning in a free choice learning institution, the programs I plan and develop, excuse me, I'm still getting over this cold. The programs that I plan and develop start for children 4 years and up. Through your studies, have you come across an age where interest in a particular topic, animals, nature, conservation, etc., really starts to take root in an individual to create the motivation to learn more about that topic? So I'll start with Nancy and see if she has an answer. And then in lieu of that, I have a reference that we can go back to, a source where I and others who are interested in that question might want to go for a little more information.
So I haven't really run across in my research on interest anything about that, which is really kind of strange. And then I did a quick Google search, and I really didn't find any scholarly journal articles addressing that those items specifically. Anecdotally, I would say, just knowing what I know about programs for small children, I think interest in nature and animals happens very early. I know for me, it was age 4 or 5. I know a woman who teaches at Avery House Nature Center. If people are from Corvallis, it's an environmental education place here in Corvallis, and they do a preschool, and the kids are already very excited about nature well before they hit kindergarten.
Great. And I know there has been some work in informal settings, particularly around dinosaurs, that again shows that not only do children have strong interest in those kinds of topics very early on, but actually often preschool children already have greater expertise in those topics than the adults that they're with. And that's not trivial, because in order to have expertise, as we've been talking, interest is related to cognition. And if you have expertise, it's because that interest has already moved beyond situated interest to more of an individual interest. Where the reason kids lose their interest in dinosaurs is because they're not surrounded by adults who support that interest. There is a little bit of a review article that you can find on informalscience.org. And if you're not familiar with informalscience.org, it's the website of the Center for the Advancement of Informal Science Education. You check out. That's a plug. Up until 5 months ago, I was the co-directors of the CASE, which is the acronym for Center for the Advancement of Informal Science Education, of the CASE project. I'm now an advisor and no longer a co-PI of that project, but they have a really interesting website and they have a lot of research and evaluation as well as summary of data. And there is a post on there called Science and Early Childhood. And if you go on to informalscience.org and in as a search term, early childhood science interest or science interest in early childhood, you'll find this article, which has, it's a short little article, but it's got a number of references. One of our colleagues, Scott Pattison, and actually his advisor, another familiar name, Lynn Dierking, have done some work on this. And another person who's done a lot of work is at the University, I think is Indiana, University of Indiana, and by the name of Alexander. And she had, and again, if her, some of her work is cited there. But that's a reference for you, Tanya, and anybody else who's interested in that topic. So again, we're down to less than 10 minutes, but it's not too late. If you have a question, call in at 657-383-1722. And maybe for the next 5 minutes, I'm going to get Nancy to talk a little bit about advanced organizers and prior knowledge and experience.
Okay.
Sort of wax ecstatic about those topics as best you can.
John gave me a heads up on what he was going to be talking about. And so I know we were
supposed to. That's an advanced organizer.
Right. So I know we were supposed to be talking about in the context of constructivist learning. And as you all know from reading your constructivist learning articles, that learning theory asserts that we do not learn from a kind of transmission absorption model, but in fact, we are all constructing our own knowledge from our experiences and our prior knowledge. And so prior knowledge is, of course, really, you can't learn without prior knowledge. It's absolutely essential in learning. And so what an advanced organizer does is it tries to help you to make those connections between your prior knowledge and your mental models or schema of what, how the world works and the meaning you've made of the world. Take that and make a bridge, make a connection between that and new information that you're being taught or you're experiencing wherever you might be learning. What was the rest of the question?
Yep. Well, I'll take this moment.
Okay.
We still have time. If somebody wants to call in for a question, 657-383-1722. It's not too late to call in for a question. I encourage you to do so. So, so one of the things that's really important and one of the things we're talking about in this class is the role and value of prior knowledge and in terms of how people construct their understanding. So what difference does it make, you know, if you were designing an educational program, whether it was at a community college or at a museum or even in a classroom? Why should you really care? I mean, you touched on this, but why would you care about what somebody brings to that learning experience?
Well, because what someone brings to that learning experience is going to be extremely relevant to whether that person is able to learn what you're trying to teach them. So if someone comes in what's the euphemism we use when they're wrong about science?
Preconceptions.
Alternate conceptions. So they don't quite, they of course have made meaning of the world around them, but perhaps not in the way that you would have liked them to. But they have some belief. And the information that you would like them to take home does not mesh with that belief. And as you know from constructivism, these mental models that we have, we can either assimilate, if the information meshes with our existing models in our head, that's great. We assimilate that information, we construct, we add, we build to our knowledge base, that's great. But what about when what you're trying to teach someone is completely at odds with how they understand the world works? Well, then they're going to go home, if you're not aware of that phenomenon, they're going to go home not understanding the world the way that you would hope that they would. And so it's really important to understand where people are coming from, because if their understanding is completely at odds with the accepted understanding, then you have some work to do. And, you know, the word that you're learning in class is probably accommodation. So they have to find a way to adapt, to change their model, their mental model, their schema, in a way that accommodates this new information. And that's really hard. And there's, you know, a whole body of research on conceptual change, trying to help people change their conceptions about how the world works so that it does meet our, you know, the scientifically accepted way of the world working. And so I guess what it comes down to is you need to know what your learners think, what their understanding of the world is, before you can try to help them develop new understandings of the world or different understandings of the world.
Cool, thanks. Actually, one of my favorite anecdotes was a guy who was the former director of a science center in North Carolina. And he said that what people learn at his science center is what they sort of already knew. And that was actually really, turns out, actually, after more than 30 years of research, I've come to confirm that that's actually true, that most people walk into a place like a science center or a zoo or aquarium sort of knowing lots of things. And what they spend the most time doing while they're in those settings is confirming their understanding of the world. And I dare say, although people don't want to admit it, that's probably what happens in classrooms too, is that most people have a conception of the world. They sort of understand the way the world works. And they spend most of their mental energy trying to convince themselves that what they sort of already know is actually true. And so understanding, if your goal is to support people's learning, understanding what they sort of already know is really, really important, because actually that is the foundation on which people are going to begin their learning journey. And if you don't understand what they sort of already know, if you don't understand where they're starting from, then actually your probability of making a difference educationally is pretty close to slim to none. And so that's a really good thing to leave you, good thought to leave you with, as we sort of wrap up this radio show for today. And so as you do your reading over the course of the next week or so, as you do your assignment, and sometime in the next couple of days, I'm going to email all of you some specifics. You have an assignment to do, and I need to give you a advance organizer to use before you conduct that assignment, and I will be sending that out over the next couple of days. And be thinking about advance organizers, be thinking about prior knowledge, be thinking about the role of interest, and I look forward to reading your posts over the next week or two. I look forward to reading your assignments as well. Thanks to all of you who participated actively in the first 2 weeks of this course. I've talked to those of you who haven't, you know who you are, and I look forward to your active participation as well as we roll into the second fifth of this class. It's hard to believe, but we're already 20% down, and so this quarter is going to go fast. Maybe for some of you, not fast enough, but it's it's going to be a quick ride through this topic of the personal dimension of learning. So thanks all of you for listening, and thanks Nancy so much for being my special guest today, and look forward to talking to you. We're done.
Done.
Boom.
Just like that.
And episode.